The following presentation is from North Pine Baptist Church. We trust that it will help you learn more about God and His message for the world. For more information and to connect with us, visit npbc.org.au.
Good evening, one and all. It's just turned 7:30, so we will get started as we're meant to do. So, let me pray. Father in heaven, we want to give you thanks that we can be together tonight, and we pray that you might guide us as we think through these issues, and we pray that we might perhaps be better informed and better equipped as we through this talk and into the world and from all and the day after and the day after that. Amen. So we're looking at the issue of developing a worldview and then why it's important. This is kind of an introductory talk, and we'll be continuing some of the concepts and exploring them further in November as well. So, if I were to do all that I could do, we'd be here for rather a long time, and of course we need to stick to time to do the right thing. So, welcome, and it's good to see you all here. As you're aware, we have the school holidays off, but it seems like a bit of a long time since we last gathered. I'd like to post that people coming out. Now, just a word of warning in advance. This is going to be occasional time, not very many times, just a couple of times, when I'm going to ask that you might maybe even talk to a human being somewhere near you. Now, I know for some people that's kind of a threatening thing. So, it's not bad. You don't have to say much. It's just to get you thinking a little bit. So we'll move on to this slide. Now, some of you will be familiar with the situation that once occurred, and probably still occasionally occurs in India, amongst some Hindu people, you might be aware of the practice of sati or futi. In 1829, and Greenwich remembers this. In 1829, the British Raj outlawed suti, that is, widow burning. They simply made it illegal. Now, it had been a customary practice. Not everybody experienced this, but the idea was that if your husband died, if you were a dutiful wife, you would throw yourself on the funeral pyre and be burned to death. And the British, who were in charge at the time, thought that was perhaps not a good practice, and so they determined that they would ban it, so they actually made it illegal. So here's the first occasion when you get to actually chat a little bit. Were the British Raj right in imposing their particular cultural, maybe even imperialistic preferences upon a people that whose country they had occupied? Were they right? Have a little chat for a moment. I won't ask for a rise in hands later, but just a little chat, see what you think. One more minute. Right. Now, I'm not going to ask where you positioned yourself, but the point I wanted to make simply is this, that if you decided, or you believed, or convinced that it was completely appropriate for the widowed woman to die of being burned to death, then you have a particular worldview. You have a particular set of parameters, you have a particular understanding of who you are, your place in the world, and how that should operate. If you say otherwise, you will have another kind of worldview. Some interesting things in the background to this whole situation. For the Hindus, particularly of the higher caste, the Brahmin, many believe, based on their particular worship of a particular deity, that they should imitate that deity. There was one who supposedly, apparently, held God's eyes, I don't know, but apparently done that. And his wife threw herself on his funeral pyre, but because they're both gods, they both come back to life again. Life is a definite impairment for them.
Due to a technical issue, a portion of this recording was missed.
And I think this is from a book that was talking about worldviews. And it simply writes, on his way home from work every day, a man walked past the clockmaker's shop. He would ritualistically stop outside, synchronize his watch with a clock that's in the window of the store. Observing this routine, the clockmaker one day struck up a conversation with the man and asked him what kind of work he did. And he said he was a timekeeper at a nearby factory, and that his malfunctioning watch necessitated daily readjustment. Part of his job was to ring the knock-off bell every day at 4 o'clock. To get this right, he synchronized his watch every morning with a clock in the watchmaker's window. The clockmaker, rather embarrassed, said, I hate to tell you this, but my clock doesn't work properly either, and I've been adjusting it to the bell I hear every afternoon from the factory at 4 o'clock. Now, obviously, and the obvious point is simply this. For something to be right or accurate, a reliable and authoritative reference point is required. Right? A reliable and authoritative reference point is required. So, having said a few of those things, what then is a worldview? So I'm going to offer just a few fairly straightforward definitions. And there are some much more complex ones, but these ones will serve our purposes. So first up, this is James Sy. Now, James Sy, if you want to read a book on worldviews, James Sy is the man. And he wrote The Universe Next Door and a few other things after that. He's kind of the guru of worldviews. So if you, pick up the list and think, oh, I'd like to know more about that, James Sy is a good thing. Anything written by James Sy, particularly The Universe Next Door, is the book to read. Anyway, he says, a worldview is a commitment, a fundamental orientation at the heart that can be expressed as a story or in a set of presuppositions, that is, assumptions which may be true, partially true, or entirely false, you just happen to believe them, and that we hold, either consciously or subconsciously, consistently or inconsistently, about the basic constitution of reality, and that provides the foundation on which we live and move and have our being. In other words, it's the fundamental things we believe, and we bring it to our understanding of the world as we experience it. A shorter one, a worldview may be understood as a framework or a set of fundamental beliefs through which we view the world and our place in it. Straightforward and very simple. Or a worldview is simply the sum total of our beliefs about the world, the big picture that directs our daily decisions and actions. And so we have those kinds of things as just basic definitions. So really what we're thinking about is, how do we understand the world in which we live? And how do we then, on the basis of that understanding, act in the world in which we live? The reality, of course, is that no matter what we claim, no one is neutral. No one is neutral. Chuck Colston said, our choices are shaped by what we believe is real and true, right and wrong, good and beautiful. And we all have a worldview either by design or by default. Whether we know it or not, and whether we can articulate it or not. So if you just to wander up to someone and say, hey, what's your worldview? There's a good chance they won't be able to say it. They're not going to speak it out. But they will have one. You'll be able to tell by what they say and by what they do. Now, the secular politician, for example, or the secular commentator, who condemns someone like, say, Tony Abbott, or Kevin Rudd, or Scott Morrison, for bringing religion into politics, is trying to suggest that he or she is neutral, and that Tony and Kevin and Scott are not. Because somehow or other, the secularists claim that they're objective and neutral, and those religious are not any of those things. It's just a fair thing. It's simply not true. The very fact that they make the comments they do is a reflection of their worldview. They're far from neutral, but fail to either recognize it or admit it. They're either deceived or they're simply lying. And there's not really any other options in between. So, if Christians are convinced that the acquisition of knowledge and wisdom begins with the fear of the Lord. The fear, of course, refers to awe, as in AWE, or reverence. And in the context in which we're speaking, it's a recognition that God is the source of all that is and is the necessary starting point for properly understanding the world and our place in it. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom and our understanding of God will inform the way we think and act. And if you're familiar with these two verses, of course, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. And for those who are not Christians, their reference point will obviously not be God, but their reference point will be whatever they have decided to put in the place of God. That is, whatever they have determined to be ultimate. And that's the key. So as we speak with others, one of the things to try to listen for is what have they declared or determined to be ultimate? What's the thing that guides their thinking? Is it at its most fundamental or elemental? And we will develop that a little bit further as we go. Now, I'm going to give you a handout. It's a every day you get one, I'm going to give it to you. Now, what you are getting is a series of sets of questions that you can pose in order to determine or understand a worldview, whether it's someone else's or your own. There's a variety of them. There's some are more detailed than others, but they all cover much the same basic ground. Now, I won't go through them all, you can actually see them. They do overlap, and some are just more detailed than others. But they come from a variety of sources, so you can see there each of the sources is cited. Again, if you want to read something that's pretty accessible, Simon Smart's A Spectator's Guide to Worldviews is a good book to read. If you want to read something that might be a bit more challenging, then anything by J.P. Morland, would be in that sphere, like in a slightly more complicated way. And you can see over on the back of the page, James Sire, and his more detailed questions. and then Charles and Nancy Kinsey. I'd recommend you, if you're interested in reading stuff about this kind of thing, anything written by Nancy Kinsey is worthwhile. She's a very accessible writer and just incredibly capable and clever. So I would so she paired up with Charles Poston way back to Right Time Now, so we've written a whole range of books in her under her own name since then, and I've read about three of them. They're all very, very good, well worth the while, so just do a search for her name and have a look if there's anything of interest to you. I'll just highlight two. So set two, basic question, who am I? What's the nature and task of human beings? Where am I? What's the nature of the world and the universe that I live in? Do I see the world and the universe as personal, or ordered, or controlled, or chaotic? Or it must be disordered, or random? What's wrong? Why is it that my world appears to be not the way it's supposed to be? How do I make sense of evil? What's the solution? Where do I find hope for something better? And those sort of questions are kind of basic. You know, some will add other things, like what happens after I die, that kind of stuff. Some will be more blunt, say, is there a God? But those are the kinds of questions that are pretty basic to thinking about worldviews. If you go then over to set six, the last one on the back, it just says, every worldview can be analysed by the way it answers three basic questions. They cheated a bit here, because they've actually got two basic questions in the first one, they called it one. Anyway, so, where did we come from and who are we? So the creation question. What has gone wrong with the world, in Christian terms? The fall. And what can we do to fix it? And so, but the reality is that all worldviews deal with those three kinds of issues. You know, origins, problems, and solutions. So all of that's on. Now, just keep that with you for a little bit. And we move along, and then get to use that eventually. So the main thing for you at the right moment is not to lose it. Because in the classroom, I think you're going to lose it by the time I finished and got to the next bit. Okay, so, a little illustration here. It's suggesting here then that everyone has a worldview, but that worldviews have consequences. So everyone has a worldview, and worldviews have consequences. I'll give you an example from history, particularly concentrating on Friedrich Nietzsche and Adolf Hitler. So you consider their version, particularly the notion that they are both atheists, and some of the consequences that arise from that. So, you may be aware, you may not be okay. Towards the end of the 19th century, there was a German philosopher who launched a really strong attack on Christianity. He saw Christianity as the enemy of civilization because it valued, especially values humility and love. Kind of reasonable pose, but anyway, that's what he did. And championed the cause of the weak. He actually saw it, therefore, as a de-civilizing or an uncivilizing influence. It makes you break down civilization. In order to be civilized, you need to be strong. Christianity was weak. According to Friedrich Nietzsche, civilization needs to be led by the strong. In his book, Antichrist, he wrote, I call Christianity the one great curse, the one enormous and innermost perversion, the one great instinct of revenge for which no means are too venomous, too underhand, too underground, and too petty. He's so minded about such things. I think he's even just offended from the Premier Victoria. He also wrote a parable, and it's fairly lengthy. Often his philosophy is more of a story-like. He wrote a parable called The Madman. And in it, a madman runs about the streets looking for God, eventually pronouncing him dead. God is dead, we have killed him. Now, you might remember that Time magazine cover from people were saying from years ago, in the 60s or 80s, which pronounced God is dead. Well, it comes from Nietzsche, and much earlier, of course. So he said, God is dead, we have killed him. And having killed God, there is only one thing left for us to do. We must take his place. Is not the greatness of this deed too great for us? Must we not ourselves become God's people to seem worthy of it? And then the parable concludes, it has been related further that on the same day the madman entered diverse churches and then sang his requiem and penum deo, that is eternal rest to God, before he died. Led out and called to account, he is said to have replied to each time, what are these churches now if they are not the tombs and sepulchres of God? Okay? Now, an interesting view. Nietzsche had an atheistic worldview and has been incredibly influential over decades and certainly right through the 20th century and even today. Some of the things that people are thinking and espousing now have come really from Nietzsche. His particular philosophy had an impact on the likes of people like, you know, some of the great authors like Bernard Shaw, D.H. Lawrence, W.B. Yeats, and some of the great writers in the 20th century. His work also influenced the founders of modern psychological theory, people like Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung. He was read and admired by Stalin and Mussolini. In fact, Adolf Hitler personally gave Benito Mussolini a copy of Nietzsche's works. Nietzsche was Hitler's favourite philosopher. He read his works, regularly visited a museum set up in Nietzsche's honour. Nietzsche's concept of the Übermensch, or the supermen, provided a conceptual framework for Adolf Hitler's concept of the master race, as the super race, and of his plan to obliterate the weak and inferior from the earth. Disabled, the mentally impaired, the gypsies, and the Roma, the Jews, the Slavs, all of those are weaker races. They work in the word Übermen, or Übermens. Hitler's final solution was Hitler putting Nietzsche's atheistic worldview into action. Worldviews have consequences. 6 million Jews bore the consequences of Hitler's worldview. I'm going to give you another handout. Any young person wants to help. So as you get that, you'll find that the quote at the bottom, which is from Mein Kampf, says, if nature does not wish that weaker individuals should mate with stronger, she wishes even less that a superior race, like the Germanic race, should intermingle with an inferior, like the Jewish race. Why? Because in such a case, her efforts throughout hundreds and thousands of years to establish an evolutionary higher stage of being may thus be rendered futile. So it's all the Jews, so it doesn't disturb the form of evolutionary development. And the other one, and this is actually on a plaque that was originally in Auschwitz, says, I freed Germany from the stupid and degrading fallacies of conscience and morality. We will train young people before whom the world will tremble. I want young people capable of violence, imperious, relentless, cruel. Strong words. Okay, here's your task. This is your job right at the moment. Have a chat with one another and see if you can go through set two of the worldview questions and what answers would these will be behind these quotes. So, answer those questions in the light of those quotes. What would Adolf Hitler think? How would he answer those questions based on what you see before you? So, here you go. give you one more minute. Alright, so now you will have perhaps arrived at a few answers to those few questions, or you might miss the first one still, that's fine. Something to think through later. If you will ask yourself the simple question of, such as, what for Adolf Hitler is ultimate? What does he put in the place of God? I suspect the answer would be Adolf Hitler. In a similar way, to that in China today, Xi Jinping would be the same. Or Vladimir Putin would be the same. And so we have that kind of situation. So Hitler's worldview and the actions perpetrated within the logical consequences of his interpretation of the atheistic worldview views promulgated by people like Friedrich Nietzsche and Charles Darwin. There is the notion of what we call existentialism, the idea that there is only existence, and existence has no particular meaning, that there's no such thing as an essence of somebody, something human, that there is just existence, and then we just create our own meaning as we please. So we have that idea, and of course the idea of Darwinian evolution, which is the notion of survival of the fittest, as far as Hitler was concerned. So the 50 million to 75 million, because figures are uncertain, that actually who died in World War II, have Hitler's worldview, his political and social philosophy, to thank. The justification for the murder of 12,000 people a day in Auschwitz is the same. It's an outworking of Hitler's worldview. The insanity that was World War II was predicted by Nietzsche's parable of the madman. He knew that if God was dead, the world would go mad, for it had lost its moral reference point. Meaning would be lost. There would be no apparent purpose. The people had become so dependent on a God to provide such things that his death would result in meaninglessness and purposelessness, and ultimately madness. And it's kind of interesting here because Nietzsche then went on to say, because how do you live in that kind of context? If that's clearly what happens, and if you have no God, then what else can happen? But he said that Nietzsche then thought that from this period of madness would emerge a race of supermen, people who had learned to live without God, who had in effect become gods themselves. Because, as we know, the reality is quite different from that. Malcolm Muggeridge, whom you may be familiar with, he observed, as he said, if God is dead, somebody is going to have to take his place. It will be megalomania or erotomania, the drive for power or the drive for pleasure, the clenched fist or the phallus, Hitler or Hugh Hefner. I don't mean assuming what many options available. That either a power monger or a sex peddler who take the reins in the place of God is very much in keeping with the disarray that we find in society today. We see it in play in a whole array of areas. We just mentioned power mongers like Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping. But we could also mention the aggressive activism of supportive transgenderism. In a different field. So those kinds of things have come to the fore. Why? Because people can create their own meaning because there is no moral reference point that is universal. There was a debate back in 1948 between Fred Copperstone, a Roman Catholic, and Bertrand Russell, atheistic philosopher, And they had a debate that covered issues like businesses of God and morality and so on. And at about the midway point, Copplestone simply asked Russell, on what basis he differentiated between right and wrong? And Russell said that it was on the same basis as he differentiated between colours. And so Copplestone then pointed out the weakness of the analogy, for one differentiates between colours, as in like a preference for them, on the basis of seeing them. So he asked how he differentiated between good and bad. And Russell said he did on the basis of feeling. Now, Copplestone was a gentleman's scholar, and so he didn't rip the man apart at that point, which he easily could have, just his logic alone. And he chose not to do that. But the point's pretty obvious. What if, what if one person or culture feels that it's right to kill and eat their neighbours? And another person's culture feels that it's better to love your neighbours? I wonder which feeling Russell would concur with. I wonder to which person or culture he would, or which person or culture he would prefer next door to. And so the application is always, it has to work out in real world. So without a universal moral referent, there can be no genuine morality. Right and wrong is determined by whoever is most powerful at any given time. And societies descend to chaos or are subjected to tyranny as a consequence. And we, of course, see that playing out constantly in the Western world right now as we more and more move away from a Christian worldview or some vague appearance to it. And we see it in our abortion laws, for example, where individuals are seen as determiners of their own destiny and the creators of their own morality, and so they kill their unborn children and think it's good to do that. And even in other areas as well, this kind of debate, so things like euthanasia and so on, and obviously the ongoing debate currently about gender reassignment, that kind of stuff has been now poured. All of those things come out of the loss of or the absence of a universal moral reference. There was a pop group back in the 60s, and I think Brian remembers this, and we used to dance to it, so that by King Crimson, and the song was called Epitaph, and one of the verses says, "Knowledge is a deadly friend when no one sets the rules. The fate of all mankind I see is in the hands of fools." And I think there's some truth in all that. Now, I'm not suggesting that all atheists are directly evil people and don't have a moral framework. Many are still relying upon the capital left behind by Christian worldview. And they were served quite bluntly and very in an unashamed kind of fashion, without even blinking, that to do certain things as well. And so you generally find, for example, that the cardinal sexual sin is pedophilia. So adultery is okay, and homosexuality is okay, but pedophilia is wrong. And when you try to find out the grounds of that might be, the best that seems to be able to come up with is that the child hasn't made a choice. And so the thing behind it all is this idea of personal autonomy, the power of the individual to make choices for themselves. So I'm going to conclude with just a kind of framework that certainly might think through. So how do we kind of arrive at a worldview? And the theory is, from my perspective, is that next time we'll explore some of this further and then apply it more biblically. And what is a biblical worldview? What do we do with it? And also the idea of detecting others' worldviews. And some of these things we've been used for these guidelines so far we've been used for already. So a worldview needs to address the main issues of human existence. Origins, where it comes from, condition, where we like, how ought we act, and purpose, why we're here. And then destiny, where am I going? Now, we take that as all valid and true. Let's break it down a bit further. A few conditions that we should take or keep in mind. The first one is a worldview must be tenable. It must begin with truth and be able to be argued. If it's not true, it can't be argued. So it needs to be easy based on truth and be able to be argued. You will find very often that when you speak with others, they will speak fallaciously. They will not speak truth, though they may believe it to be true. So, for instance, they'll try to argue that there is no connection between, say, biology and gender. All of us here will probably think that that's not true. But there are others who will promote that as though it is true without thinking. Secondly, a worldview must be livable. So it's got to work at the level of experience. It's got to somehow work at the world in which we actually live. So you can't sort of start making pronouncements. So if you think of, say, Hitler's worldview or the worldview of some of the dictators in the world today, that worldview is probably livable for them and their sort of claims in power, and not livable for others. So to give Vladimir Putin, it's not a livable worldview for Ukrainians. A worldview must be transferable. Now that will mean it has to be able to be applied in a broad range of contexts. If it's true and if it's livable, then it's always true and always livable. And so you can take it as a sort of foundation of truth and a foundational notion of experience and reality, and be able to apply that in a context. If it's true in this context, it'll be true in that context as well. So you have the notion then of truth, experience, and prescription, and say, this is what should be. So when one starts with the truth, it should be able to be proven in experience and then justifiably prescribed to others. And then one final thing. So a good worldview will, firstly, correspond with reality. That is, it'll have strong factual support. It can't just pick and choose the bits of reality to suit. There is a thing in philosophy called the correspondence theory of truth. That is, the thing that is claimed must correspond with the world as it really is. So there's that part. The second bit, it must have a high degree of coherence. In other words, it has to be internally consistent. It can't be logically contradictory within itself. There's a thing called the law of non-contradiction, a basic law in philosophy. The law of non-contradiction simply says A cannot be non-A at the same time and in the same sense. A cannot be non-A at the same time and in the same sense. So, for instance, just by way of example, this is one I could say is the poor prospect that I've been happily married for 46 years, maybe for 47. It's been the greatest year of my life. I could say, just as a statement, I am divorced, I am married. If I was making that claim at the same time, the same sense, it would be contradictory, therefore come true. But if I was divorced 10 years ago and have now married, then it is true, it's not at the same time in the same sense. But where things are clearly contradictory, one of them can be wrong. And so there's that. The other ones have a degree of explanatory power, provide laws or whatever it might be, that help explain our experience in the world. Again, if philosophy is called abductive reasoning, that is the inference to the best explanation. Yeah, the inference to the best explanation. So you look at all the evidence that you can find and say, what base theory explains this best? So it needs to do that. And it therefore, and then also needs to refute contrary worldviews. And here the law of non-contradiction applies again. So it applies not only within a worldview, it can't be internally contradictory, but also between worldviews. Because if one worldview is wrong, other worldviews that contradict it must necessarily be wrong. So one's right, the others must necessarily be wrong. Now, there's much more that I could continue with, but I won't today because it's reached 20 times. And we'll take this up next time if you're willing to come out again. So it's kind of what you've done today is kind of introduce the idea, show the questions that need to be answered by a worldview, look at some of the framework and the philosophical underpinnings just very briefly, and then provide some examples of it in action, and recognize that worldviews have consequences. And we deal with that day by day. And I guess part of the hope that I would have is that as we're better informed, as we even if we think about it, we probably know this stuff already now, but as we think about it, we're going to identify where someone else is coming from, what their motive, the ultimate is, so that we might know how we can, you know, a peaceful, or a rank, or a calm, a considered, fashion, discuss matters. We may not get the same response, by the way, but if we're coming from that position ourselves, then we might be consistently able to apply the sorts of things that Peter said when we share the gospel with others, and we offer a defense, but we do so gently, trying to maintain the peace, putting forward arguments rather than screaming and shouting and exercising anything other than persuasive power.
Thanks for joining us for this presentation from North Pine Baptist Church. For more information and to connect with us, visit npbc.org.au.